From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. From Mike Myers to Steve Carell, from Stephen Colbert to Tina Fey, Chicago's Second City Theater has always served as an incubator for budding world-class talent, giving us a comedic twist on our news and culture. And this weekend, the legendary comedy troupe will perform at the Englert Theater in Iowa City. In today's first half hour, I talk with members of Second City's national touring company. Then, Mike Thomas, author of the new book, The Second City Unscripted. In it, Thomas traces the history of the 50-year-old comedy troupe through interviews with many of its biggest stars. That's all coming up. First, a look at this hour's news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In 1959, a group of Chicagoans joined forces to open a hip new venue dedicated to coffee, cigarettes, conversation, and comedy. The result was a nightly cabaret featuring a troupe of quick-thinking young comics skewering everything from politics to pop culture. For 50 years, the Second City Theater has delighted audiences and served as an incubator for budding world-class talent. Its alumni include Alan Arkin, Dan Aykroyd, Martin Short, Conan O'Brien, Bonnie Hunt, Amy Sedaris, Steve Carell, Stephen Colbert. The list goes on and on. Later in the hour, I talk with Mike Thomas, author of the new book, The Second City Unscripted. In it, Thomas, a longtime staff writer for the Chicago Sun-Times, traces the history of the 50-year-old comedy troupe through interviews with many of its biggest stars. First, though, this weekend, members of Second City's national touring company will be performing at the Englert Theater in Iowa City. That's on Friday and Saturday evenings. The title of their performance, The Second City's 50th Anniversary Tour. One show, 50 years, a million laughs. Joining me now, members of Second City's national touring company. I believe I have Ryan Archibald on the phone. Ryan, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good afternoon.
Great to have you with us. In a moment, we hope to have Natalie Sullivan joining us as well, but you're on solo at first on stage, so to speak, Ryan. What can you tell us about the show coming to Iowa this weekend?
It's a really good show. It's an exciting show, and it's made up of it's a bit of a greatest hits. So we have scenes in it that were written in the 60s and a scene in from the 70s, 80s, all the way up to current material. And it does a great job of demonstrating what Second City is famous for, and that's political and social satire, with some improvisation thrown in for extra measure. And we happen to be a group that does a lot of singing and so there's a lot of music in this show, so we get to highlight some of Second City's musical history as well in this running order.
I think Natalie Sullivan has now joined us on the line from Chicago as well. Good afternoon, Natalie.
Hi.
Hi, great to have you with us. Talking about the show coming to Iowa this weekend that you and Ryan will be on with. Mm-hmm. Natalie, can you give us an example of one of the classic skits you'll be putting on for us from a past age of Second City?
Sure. One of the most popular sketches in our history, I think, that we have in our show is called Grandma's Records, and it is a scene that is from a review that featured Rachel Dratch and Tina Fey a few years back, and it's kind of it's set in a church, and you see a nun's funeral begin, and we're trying to find an appropriate record to play at her funeral, and as it turns out, they're all kind of R-rated records. So it's this funny clash of context with these religious people trying to find a record that does not have profanities in it.
Uh-huh. Ryan, do you have another classic scene you can tell us about a little bit?
Sure. We have a scene in the show written in 1961. It's called University of Chicago. And basically, as you know, University of Chicago doesn't have any athletics. And the scene kind of takes a look at what would happen if football came back to the University of Chicago. So it's a scene where a coach is teaching these three kind of like nerdy, wimpy intellectuals how to play football, and they keep you know, asking questions like, so what does X stand for? You know, they want to know if it's a, you know, variable or not. And they're approaching it as like, you know, like they're learning a math equation and he's trying to teach them football. And it's a really fun scene, and it still translates to today. And it's a blast to do.
Of course, improv is a great legacy of Second City. What sort of improv will you be having in this show?
Well, we do a lot of what we call Second City structured improv. So like Ryan was saying, we do a lot of music in the show. And there are a couple specific scenes that are musically based where we take suggestions about people from the audience and improvise a song based on their life.
So if you're in the audience, you may be singled out.
You could be.
Yes. Yes.
You could be. And
but only to highlight you. Like, we like to raise our, you know, put our audience on a pedestal. We like to raise them up. So.
Okay. Now, I understand the opening song talks about the differences between the Second City of the 1959 or the 60s and now. What are those differences in live comedy? Comedy in general, comparing it to the previous decades?
Well, I've heard some of the original members tell a story that, you know, even just back then, even just to say the president's name on stage was really edgy and cutting edge. Like, you know, you never heard anyone just get on stage and just mention Eisenhower. You know, that was kind of like would call the hush to go over the room. That became really interesting.
Why would that be? Why would that be?
Well, I think just because comedy back then, they kept things very, very simple and very broad, and to criticize your government wasn't common practice in stand up at the time. I mean, this is pre, you know, Lenny Bruce and things like that. So, so nowadays, you know, we still are an edgy theater, but we certainly dive straight into the issues of the day. And so, you know, I think that's consistent. It's just what we can get away with is, you know, so much grander than what they used to.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if, in looking back at the previous decades of Second City, the five decades of it up to this point, if political issues have always been addressed, I understand, but has that changed? Or are we sadly dealing with the same political issues again and again? Natalie?
I think that the point that Second City makes in its satire is to see things from both sides, and so there's always something good to go after. I mean, certainly there's always political turmoil, things to make fun of, and I think that our strength is that we get to see it from both sides. So even if things change for the better or for the worse, there's still something there for comedy gold to look at. You know, we, I think, go after both sides equally. I mean, Second City is traditionally kind of a liberal theater, but then, you know, we can see the comedy in that too. When liberals fumble or when conservatives fumble, we can always find something no matter what's going on in the climate.
So when you're touring with Second City, are you always wherever you are in the country, waking up, looking at headlines, listening to NPR or wherever you get your news, and then saying, I'm mining for raw material right now as I drink my morning cup of coffee?
Yeah, I think that's always a smart thing to do, especially to know your regional feelings. You know, I mean, it's always good. There's usually points in the show that we can make small adjustments to sort of customize them to what's going on in that particular area.
Absolutely. And we always have a third act of improvisation in our show as well. And that's also a great time to demonstrate to a local audience that you know something about something about where they're from as well. And so, yeah, I also know that having a smartphone, it was one of the best things for my improv, because at any point in time, I can just get online and read and look for information to use on stage.
So you actually, do you do this on stage? You use your smartphone on stage?
Not on stage, but I've used it, like, in between scenes, like backstage, looking through stuff. Like, what was the name of that football coach I need? I wanted to use his name, so I've, like, gone right back stage and looked it up online.
So people think you're incredibly intelligent when you step back on stage. You've got a great memory.
What an amazing wealth of knowledge that man has. Yeah. I'm like the internet in my brain. So,
how much of any one show is improv and how much is scripted? Does it go from one end to the other? So some of it is solidly scripted where there's not much variance, or and then all the way to completely open up?
I mean, it depends on the particular order of that show. I'd say in general, like, there could be maybe 20% improv. I mean, like I said, we do have those sort of structured improv moments in our show where, you know, we know basically where we're headed, but we need the information from the audience to get there. Ryan,
and,
I don't know, what do you think of
throughout Second City's history, we've used improvisation more as a tool, as a writing tool to create. So all of the written scenes that are in our show were first improvisations and were kind of retooled and redone until now they're very polished, tight pieces of theater. And I think that's what makes Second City unique. And then we also have improvisation where we're just creating in front of the audience as the final product. And that mostly comes in our third act after the written material.
Mm-hmm. Now, improv is a tool, is a muscle in the actor's repertoire that not all actors have developed. What's the key to successfully learning improv? Are there rules you follow, things you always want to remember when you're in improv mode?
Yeah, there are. I mean, I know that a lot of our actors at Second City are also improv teachers and instructors, and something that I always say that's a little cliched if you've taken an improv class, but I ask people if they've improvised before, and if they say no, then I say, well, yeah, you have, because you've had a conversation, because most everyday conversations aren't planned out. And so for me, improv, the basic rule of it is just listen and respond.
Anything to add to that, Ryan?
Absolutely. And I think after that is we need to agree to the creative input that's been put out there by our scenic partner. So if someone makes me a doctor and has asked me for x-rays, I'm going to agree that I am a doctor, that I'm holding x-rays, and then I will add a piece of information to it after that. And I think that's a technique we call yes and. We want to agree with the information that is being given.
Okay, we have to take a short break, and we'll ask you, Ryan and Natalie, to hold on, please. And I'd like to put you on the spot when we come back and ask you to give us a demonstration of improv live on the radio here. Are you agreeable to that?
Yes.
Sure.
Okay,
sure.
We'll try that when we come back. We'll see what success we have with that. Ryan Archibald, Natalie Sullivan, they are members of Second City's National Touring Company, performing this weekend, Friday and Saturday evening at the Englert Theater in Iowa City. The title of their performance, the Second City 50th Anniversary Tour. One show, 50 years, a million laughs. If you have a comment or a question about Second City, about the nature of comedy or improv, perhaps you have a favorite Second City star to ask about, 1-866-780-9100 is our toll-free number, 1-866-780-9100, or The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. We'll be back in about 60 seconds. A comedic twist on our news and culture on today's edition of The Exchange with the Second City Comedy Theater, two members of its traveling troupe by phone with us. They'll be performing this weekend in Iowa City Friday and Saturday night to commemorate the 50th anniversary of Second City, started in Chicago in 1959. Joining us, Ryan Archibald and Natalie Sullivan. Now let's look at how we can do some improv here. Set it up here. Do you need to set it up? Tell us what you're going to be doing, because as you're doing this improv, if you could do a minute or two of improv, tell us what you're thinking going into a bit of improv, a little bit of a peek behind the curtain so we might learn how this is done.
Sure. Well, at this point, we would either get a suggestion from you or we would just start and use the first three lines to kind of establish what the situation is. I think at this point in an improvisation, I'm just trying to just see if my mind's generating a clear-cut idea of a strong initiation, or just allowing myself to be clear-headed to accept a strong initiation from Natalie.
So a strong initiation would be a situation, a given situation, is what you mean.
Yeah, so it would give multiple pieces of information, such as who we are together, where we are and what we're doing. So,
and it can be, any association of any word, too, just however, whatever that means to us.
Okay.
Right.
Where do you want that to come from? You want to generate that? You want me to tell you, or?
Go ahead and give us any suggestion of maybe an occupation.
Okay. Well, how about a possible employee? How about a job interview situation?
Great.
Do you need more information than that?
No.
Okay.
Well, thank you. Thank you for coming in here, Mr. Andrews. I see you've got a very strong background in finance.
Yeah. Thanks for bumping back the interview until the afternoon. I have a tough time with mornings.
No problem.
No, I really appreciate it. I mean, that's what I'm looking for in an employer, really, is someone that's going to be flexible with my schedule.
Well, we do begin at 8 a.m.
Okay. Well, we can talk about that then.
Okay, great. Now, I see that you have been a cashier for a very long time, strong
mm-hmm.
finance background.
Yep. I can count money, especially when the machine tells me to change, because I have a difficult time, just coming up with the change.
That's
right,
great. You wouldn't
head.
Believe how few people know computers these days.
Oh, yeah. I'm great with computers. I'm great.
Wonderful. Great. I can see that. You've pulled out your iPhone there.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I had a list of websites of great questions to ask when I was on interviews, but I guess I got a little distracted.
Oh, that's a lovely picture there that you've got.
Thanks.
There of your wife. Is that your wife or girlfriend?
No, some girl I met at a bar. It's pretty sweet, huh?
Oh.
I think we'll have to stop it right there. Natalie,
sure.
that was wonderful. Hard time holding back the laughter so I didn't go over the top of you there, right there. So during that, you didn't rehearse that. It was just one idea feeding off the next one, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's right. Yeah. And of course, we've got the the added benefit on stage would be a lot of physical cues we could give each other, such as the assumption there was an iPhone there or whatever. But
right.
I mean, just we can tell from each other's tone who our character is and.
Right.
Where we're headed.
We knew very quickly that Ryan was not likely to get the job.
Yeah, pretty much. I think that was established in the first line. Yeah.
Ryan
yeah.
was playing himself in that scene, everybody.
Now, Natalie, in learning improv, think back to before you knew improv. Was it a big challenge to learn to sort of leap into the abyss, into the unknown when you do that?
It is a challenge for sure. I mean, it's something that I think certain people are more inclined to than others, but anybody can learn the basics and learn the rules, and I'd say the center of it is trust. You have to trust the person you're on stage with. There has to be a reason for you to be together, and you just have to trust that whatever you say, they will support.
Mm-hmm. Ryan?
Yeah.
Thinking back to before, as you were learning improv?
Sure. Well, I played sports my whole life, all the way through college, and I was looking for something that kind of be a hobby, like athletics were, something to do. And I think improv was something that immediately caught my attention, because you're creating something. You have to work together with a group of people to pull something off. And you train together, then you do it in front of an audience. And there's that something about also being that immediate gratification of doing a job well done.
Mm-hmm.
Doing it in front of people, I think, just caught my attention immediately.
Listening to how easily the two of you slipped into those roles and how natural you were in doing it, I'm wondering, improv must be a skill that you've found useful in other areas of life.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. in a job situation, job interview
yeah.
situation. For sure.
A specific one, Natalie?
I would have to say that supporting and yes-anding is important everywhere. I mean, it's going to be important it's going to be important backstage in our shows when we're talking about doing improv together, and it's going to be important when you are at a job interview and you're talking to your family. I mean, it's always about listening and reacting.
Mm-hmm. I've heard Second City alumnus Tina Fey talk about one of the most valuable aspects of Second City for her was getting rid of her fear of failure. Ryan, talk about that. Is there a point when you just stop dreading failure and just get out there?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think for me it was when I realized it was part of the process as well. I mean, comedy isn't successful all the time, and performance isn't successful all the time. And I think that once you realize or have the opportunity to know that, wow, I might have failed tonight or in that scene or in that moment, but I'm going to have so many other opportunities to have success. Mm-hmm. And also, those are the moments where you learn the most. Like, why was that? You know, why did that break down? Why didn't that moment work? And that's where you learn from. That's how you grow. So I think it's the failure such a important part of our process as improvisers and as comedians.
Natalie, what do you do when you notice on stage that a skit is or an improv is just bombing? How do you change course?
I'd say the best part about improv, if something is unplanned and improvised, is that you can always completely turn it around and change your direction. I would say that if I was doing a scene where things just weren't going well, you have the option of being a different character, being a new person, and just saying, well, I said no to that. Maybe if I said yes to it, everything would be different.
Mm. We have just a couple minutes left. I wanted to end by having you look back over these 5 decades of Second City to comedians, former comedians at Second City that have really inspired you to take on this career. Can I start off with you, Ryan? Who do you look up to in the history of Second City?
I mean, currently I look up to Tina Fey. I think that she's a pretty great comedian and has done some pretty amazing things with her career. But I think growing up, I was really drawn to the comedy of like John Candy and Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd. And then, of course, I grew up watching Chris Farley and finding him amazing. So, and then once I hit Chicago and studied people like Stephanie Weir and Kevin Dorff, who I got to watch live all the time, they still continue to inspire me, for sure.
And you, Natalie?
My early memories of comedy were with Saturday Night Live, specifically with Mike Myers. Mm-hmm. My parents were huge fans of SCTV and of Saturday Night Live, and so I got it. I always knew Second City in my home when I was little, and as I got older, I think now I would definitely agree with Tina Fey, but I'd also look at Steve Carell and Steve Colbert. I mean, Stephen Colbert, just the way he's built himself this sort of empire is really impressive and amazing, and it makes me very proud that he's an alum.
Okay, very good. Natalie Sullivan and Ryan Archibald, members of Second City's National Touring Company, coming to the stage of Iowa City's Englert Theater Friday and Saturday night. Thank you for sharing improv, comedy, and the history of Second City with us for this half hour, Ryan and Natalie.
Thank you
for having us.
Coming up in just a moment here on The Exchange, my guest, Mike Thomas. He's the author of the new book, The Second City Unscripted. In it, Thomas, a longtime staff writer for the Chicago Sun-Times, traces the history of the 50-year-old comedy troupe through interviews with many of its biggest stars as we continue celebrating the 50th anniversary of Second City. That coming up in just a few minutes. We'll be back. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Criminals are using a lot of sophisticated techniques to steal identities and personal information. Tomorrow on this program, I talk with Brian Burkhart, director of the Electronic Crime Institute at the Des Moines Area Community College. This Saturday, DMAC will host a free conference to help consumers lower their risk for identity theft and increase their internet safety awareness, protecting yourself from cybercrime. That's on The Exchange tomorrow at this time. Today, a comedic twist on our news and culture, celebrating the 50th anniversary of the world-renowned Chicago comedy troupe Second City. Second City's national touring company will be performing at the Englert Theater in Iowa City on Friday and Saturday evening. The title of their performance, the Second City 50th Anniversary Tour, one show, 50 years, a million laughs. My next guest is longtime staff writer for the Chicago Sun-Times, Mike Thomas. His new book is titled The Second City Unscripted, Revolution and Revelation at the world-famous Comedy Theater. In it, Thomas traces the history of the 50-year-old comedy troupe through interviews with many of its biggest stars. Mike Thomas joins us for the remainder of the hour on the phone from Chicago. Good afternoon to you, Mike.
Good afternoon. Great to be here, Ben.
Great to have you with us. We have a couple of clips we'd like to play. But first of all, take us back to 1959. Tell us how Second City began.
Well, let me see if I can nutshell it here. 1959. I should go before 59 because actually the guys who started Second City had already hooked up at the University of Chicago. These were Bernard Sollins, Howard Alk, and Paul Sills. Sills was directing at University of Chicago. Alk was in a group there called was the Compass Players, and Bernard Sollins hooked up with that group. That would have been in the probably the early 50s. They went on to form Compass out of University of Chicago, performing taverns there. They moved to the north side of Chicago, and they also all worked together in a place called Playwrights Theater, and that was on the north side of Chicago as well, more dramatic work. So they already knew each other before they got into Second City. And Second City was basically an extension of the Compass Players, which was based in improv, these scriptless games, basically, that the actors would play on stage. They'd have a scenario and sort of go from there and create this all from scratch. And Second City used that as the basis for creating scenes. And come 59, they already had this built-in audience because people, the intelligentsia especially, had been following the Compass Players to their two locations. And so when Second City opened, there were already lines outside the door because these folks knew what they were going to get, this improv-based satire with these very intelligent, dramatic actors who were on stage there, including, Eugene Trubnik and Del Close came into the picture fairly soon thereafter. And it actually rode the wave early on of this comedy revolution that was happening in the country. People like Lenny Bruce, these are stand-ups, Lenny Bruce, Mort Saul, Shelley Berman, they were all doing the satire thing, from the stage as stand-up comics. Second City played into that with their ensemble-based satire. And you also had this local scene in Chicago that was just ripe for this stuff to survive and thrive. Hugh Hefner was hosting all these comics at his mansion on North State Parkway. Places like the Gate of Horn hosted people like Lenny Bruce. There were the Mr. Kelly's was another club in town. So it really came into being when everything was right. It was sort of like the perfect storm.
I'd like to play a little clip of one of the big names that came out of Second City, went on to Saturday Night Live, of course, Bill Murray. And this is a few years after he became a big name, back at the Second City stage, reflecting on his start, his times at Second City.
Good evening. For those of you that are not my relatives, I'm Bill Murray. Welcome to the Second City Theater. Famous theater, as you all know, is given many great performers their start, but more importantly, has killed thousands of barely talented people and has put them to death, and they're now doing the jobs they were built for, and so forth. So how are you all doing tonight? And because they couldn't meet the rugged standards here at the Second City is now 20 years old, and this is over 8,527 performances, as I was told last night. You can look it up. Now, I used to work at this place, and they paid me poorly and miserably, but they let me drink free, and I've never forgiven them for that. But I was here for 400 or 500 of those shows, and I only remember maybe 6 times. But because of the way the hard work here, they don't have writers here at the Second City, and that's probably a mistake. I've told 39 times, but all the scenes are worked out through improvisation. Scenes come out here with no... actors come up with no idea at all and try to improvise the scene and make something of it. And what you're going to see tonight is our scenes that are polished and perfected. I mean, you were going to be very excited, please, I'm sure. But you've been here on those nights, you would have seen some real ugliness and some real... I'm glad you're here tonight. But What we write about is basically the way we all live, and we all live here in Chicago, which in my opinion is the greatest city on Lake Michigan.
There's Bill Murray, as you heard, on the 20th anniversary of Second City, reminiscing about his time there and the nature of Second City comedy. There we hear about that Mike Thomas. It's really the spontaneity, the fact that the audience could, this was something new, come in and not know what was going to happen. And the performers didn't know either, right?
No, they didn't. And you know, they were thrilled, and talking with a lot of them, they said this, they were thrilled that they could actually pull something out of the newspapers or something that happened on the street that day and put it on stage that night. So it was very of-the-moment stuff as well.
So when we look back over these five decades, from 1959 up to the present, you walk us through different periods in your book. Can you give us a fast forward through these five decades, how Second City has been shaped, how it's changed its high points and low points?
Yeah, I think, you know, coming out of the 50s where you had more of this mother-in-law comedy going on, sort of the square comedy, Second City was, you know, was subversive. It was counterculture. They were, you know, they railed against the man, or whatever you want to call it. You know, as the 60s wore on, I think the actors on the stage became more involved in the stuff they were satirizing on the stage. So, for instance, when the late 60s rolled around and Harold Ramis and his cast were on stage, they knew what it was like to be in protests down in Grant Park in Chicago. And so they had this sort of immediacy to the material. They weren't detached from it. There was no distance. They know how the people were feeling. I think that really provided some amazing fodder for what they did on stage. Whether it was you know, the police clashing or the politicians, how they acted, and you know, into the 70s that continued, you had Nixon, of course, which was huge. Dan Aykroyd up in Toronto would do Nixon, and you know, when Saturday Night Live came around, that started in October of 75, took a couple of years. But once SNL started poaching from Second City, they started pulling talent like Gilda Radner and John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd and Bill Murray. Second City went from this locally revered gem to this nationally known funny farm. And Bernard Salins, co-founder, has said, you know, sort of the best of times, the worst of times, because actors began looking beyond the work to where the work would take them. And so they weren't quite as in the moment, and they got agents. But it brought people in, not only from Chicago, but when people would come to visit, they would go to Second City. And that continues to this day. And so really, from the late 70s on, in Chicago especially, you know, Second City started becoming a place to go, like, you know, the Sears Tower. You go visit there, you go to Second City, you get some deep dish pizza. You know, and then continuing into the 80s, now there were some people as Second City wore on who, critics who thought it started resting on its laurels and got a little comfortable with what it was doing, you know, still producing great talents throughout the 80s and into the 90s. You know, it wasn't really until 95 when a review came around called Piñata Full of Bees that really shook the place up. It was one of these anti-comfort shows railing against this the country that was becoming, you know, complacent and just sort of following along the status quo. And, you know, from then on, Second City turned around. There was a revitalization of energy, and that show involved Adam McKay, who now is a big director in Hollywood, Talladega Nights, Step Brothers, Scott Adsit, who is now part of 30 Rock. Tina Fey was there in the late 90s during this turnaround period. So, you know, and I think that continues on to this day.
Mike Thomas is my guest for the remainder of the hour, author of the new book, The Second City Unscripted, Revolution and Revelation, at the world-famous Comedy Theater. If you have a question about Second City and its 50 years of existence, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Now, Second City has always had a connection to politics, commentary, satire on politics of the day. I wanted to play a little excerpt. I've got off the internet earlier today, and I'm sorry I didn't note the performers in this. But here's an instance where we have a debate between two performers, and it takes off and takes to a ridiculous end some of the headlines that we've seen recently in our news.
Good evening, and welcome to the second of our nationally televised debates. At this time, I'd like to introduce our two very distinguished candidates, Congressman Chuck Jenkins and Senator Robert Galworthy. Holly Glickman of The Times will ask the first question.
Thank you. I'd like to begin this evening by asking Congressman Jenkins how he would, in fact, deal with the current national homeless situation.
Holly, I'd like to thank you for asking me that question, and I have a very good answer, which I will get to shortly. But first, I'd like to start by making a public confession. This is something that would have eventually gotten out in the press, but I feel that you, the public, will respect me all the more for coming clean with you now. You see, for the last few years, I've had a problem with alcohol, especially those 7-ounce wine coolers. I'm now in rehab and getting better and better all the time.
Please hold all your applause until the end. Senator Galworthy, your rebuttal.
Well, once again, my opponent has managed to skirt the issue. But in the same vein, since an automobile accident almost 3 years ago, I've been seriously addicted to morphine. This is something I feel you should know since I base my platform on trust. A trust I feel my constituency so richly deserves.
For the past decade, I've made the bulk of my living through the sale of pornography.
For 20 years, I was the Grand Imperial Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan.
I'm a practicing cannibal.
I'm a woman. A woman.
Who is it? Has it?
You are.
Second City Television taking public confession among politicians to a ridiculous extreme. Mike Thomas, did you identify perhaps in that, the performers?
I did not. It wasn't clear enough.
But a real stitch there. I understand that politics, you've got a new musical there being launched by Second City now that also has to do with politics of the day.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, well, I just went to the opening last night of something called Rush Limbaugh the Musical. It's the follow-up to a hit show they had. It's an offshoot of Second City called Second City Theatricals. And the first one they did was Rod Blagojevich Superstar. Obviously a parody of Jesus Christ Superstar, and Blagojevich actually showed up for that one on stage one of the nights. But this is the follow-up, and it is steeped in politics. That's run through Second City shows since it began. Bernard Sollins, again, the co-founder there, was a huge lover of politics, and he loved it when the actors would involve politics in their scenes on stage. I think especially in a city like Chicago, there is ample political fodder for people to pull for scenes, especially nowadays with our disgraced ex-governor and whatever the goings on in City Hall. This is a hotbed of politics here, and the material on stage has become in certain shows even more hyper local than maybe it was in years past too. So they're starting also to focus more again on their hometown as they did in years past.
Second City has reflected the politics of the day, but as you look past back in the 5 decades of Second City's existence, are there instances where it has influenced the politics of the day? I'm thinking of Tina Fey, instances similar to Tina Fey's portrayal of Sarah Palin, where we can say that fed into people's opinion of Sarah Palin and the election.
Well, I think back in the day there was much mocking of the first mayor Daley, Richard J. Daley. Which may have had some effect. I don't know exactly how much on how people perceived him, in Chicago. On a national basis, I'm not so sure. I think maybe the national effect came more from, shows like Saturday Night Live or SCTV. But certainly I think they've had some effect over the years. Tina Fey's portrayal of Sarah Palin was so widely played and disseminated. I think that really got in front of millions and millions of people. So that was also part of the effect, besides the fact that it was well done.
Many of us who didn't make it to Chicago to see Second City or remember it most because of SCTV, Second City TV. How did that start, and why do we think of it more as Canadian than Chicago?
Well, I mean, it started out of Canada. That's why it was basically a response to Saturday Night Live. The bosses at Second City, then including Andrew Alexander, who basically saved Second City Toronto. He came in and bought the rights from Bernard Sollins when they had started a branch up there that wasn't doing well. Andrew had the contacts, established a presence there. It stays to this day. But they all got their heads together and said, let's come up with a concept and compete with SNL. Now, I don't think they really thought they were going to go head-to-head with SNL, which was slick and well-funded and had all kinds of sponsors. So they said, they agreed on this backwoods television station where they'd have all these wacky characters, Johnny LaRue and Guy Caballero, all these fantastic characters, acting in these outrageous scenarios. And it just took off. And I talked to, a lot of fans for this. They had millions of fans, but it was always second to SNL. It was sort of, a show for the in crowd. Conan O'Brien told me that he always wondered why this show wasn't bigger. And at the same time, he thought they were kind of making it just for him. He felt it spoke to him in some special way. And it really had a big effect on him deciding to go into comedy. And he's not the only one. I mean, Ben Stiller's another huge fan. So it really, really affected a lot of these people who went into professional comedy.
Mike Thomas, your book, The Second City Unscripted, looks at many of these people. You interviewed the majority of these people, many of whom are stars now, but took them back to the time to profile them before they were stars. When you did all these interviews and profile these peoples, did you come to any conclusions about how Second City shaped them as performers?
Yeah, one big thing is that at Second City, a lot of these people felt they had a license to fail. They could try things, and if they didn't work, they weren't going to get canned. They could just pick themselves up and try something new or not do whatever it is that didn't work again. It's a place, it's competitive. But it's not competitive to the point of, say, Saturday Night Live competitive. It's a place where you learn how you handle pressure, how you handle competition. Your real self comes out. One of the cast members told me it puts you through a personality ringer. And, Bill Murray, in that clip you played, said that portion about, it weeding out people who are, barely talented. He said
right.
That with a wink. But I think it's true. People find out if they can handle this and if they're built to go on and do this for a living.
One of the key figures, a name that most people will not recognize, but a key figure in Second City, Del Close. Tell us about him.
Del Close, as former cast member Tim Kazurinsky put it, was sort of this terrible genius. You never knew what Del you were getting. I mean, he was an amazing improv teacher, and he knew how to get the best out of people on stage, how to put them in the moment and how to get the best material out of them. But he was also an unrepentant junkie for many, many years, whether it was heroin or any number of other substances he did. And so you never kind of knew which Del you were going to get, whether it was on booze or on drugs, or maybe you'd get Del who was amazingly straight and lucid and, in the moment and willing to work with you. But he could also be blustery. He was off-putting to women, claimed not to like children. So he was this, you had to deal with all that in order to get these gems from him. And a lot of people revere him. But the people I talked to also didn't look back entirely with rose-colored glasses. It was, it was kind of a warts-and-all portrayal.
Mm. Of course, we connect Second City and Saturday Night Live with also the sort of drugs and booze, to put it plainly. In 1982, we remember John Belushi dying of a cocaine and heroin overdose. How much have drugs and booze shaped Second City over the years?
Well, I think, especially in the first few decades, it was very prevalent there. It ramped up, I think, in the 60s, all through the 70s. But that was what was happening in the culture as well. There were no shows called Intervention. There was, a lot of that going on around them. So it was sort of a natural extension of the culture. But, I when John died in 82, that was 10 years after he had left Second City. John was in another world by then. There was a lot more money, a lot different people around him. I don't get the impression that John was like that at all at Second City. But, you know, in the 80s, you know, about 5 years after John died, two people who were part of the Second City family died of drug-related causes. You know, one was an actor, was chronic alcoholism, and 16 days later, a waitress there died of cocaine intoxication. And so, you know, it was apparent to me, and I think a lot of others, that Belushi's death really hadn't been the wake-up call that maybe it should have been. But as you got into the 90s, mid-90s, wearing on, it got less and less. It is not that sort of place now. Second City is not as tolerant at all about that stuff now as it was back in the day.
We have less than a minute left. The future of Second City, what do you see there?
I see them developing all kinds of stuff online, different offshoots like this Second City Theatrical. They're huge into corporate. There are 2,000 people in their workshops learning how to improvise, how to write comedy. And I just see them growing and growing. They're on seven ocean liners now, too, doing floating shows. So I don't see them going anywhere anytime soon.
Mike Thomas, I want to thank you very much. Author of the new book, The Second City Unscripted, Revolution and Revelation at the world-famous Comedy Theater, joining us live by phone from Chicago. Mike Thomas, thank you very much.
Thanks for your time, Ben.
Mike is a longtime staff writer for the Chicago Sun-Times, and we ends our celebration of 50 years of Second City. I want to remind you that the Second City troupe will be at performing at the Englert Theater in Iowa City this coming Friday and Saturday evenings. That's a celebration of the 50th anniversary of Second City. Having some problems with our theme music, Dennis. He's trying to figure that out there. A bit of unscripted background for my credits here. I'll have to just march on along. Second City, 50th anniversary, one show, 50 years, a million laughs. as mess-ups technically can be sometimes. The Exchange is produced by Jeff Schmidt and Catherine Perkins, our producer assistant today, Christoph Mai. Podcasting and on-demand audio over The Exchange available at iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music, which you didn't hear or heard in a funny way, was performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer.